question for you, Bob, since you used to be a spook, didn't you?
Yes,
okay.
I was.
There was this guy, I've been listening to his interviews, and he wrote a book called Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. In the 60s.
Oh, yeah, that's David. I know all about the guy, yeah.
Yeah, in the 60s and or the 70s. Were you a spook down there?
Yes. I met Frank Zappa in 58 when he was just getting out of high school, but that was just a casual meeting in the desert. Now, I was there in the desert because the secret consultant who I worked for were always looking for the latest new disturbing technologies or whatever. And the UFO craze started in that area in the Mojave Desert in the late 50s, and I was sent out there to look into it. So by accident, I met Frank and Don Van Vliet, who became Captain Beefheart.
You weren't involved in the military industrial complex and all that stuff that was going on?
Well, a bit above it. I worked with what was known as the Priory Scion or the Illuminati, the bankers of Europe, the oligarchs. LaRouche writes very good on them. LaRouche knows a lot of the names. I came out of Europe, a very historical wealth position, and they'd been sidelined by World War I. We know about the Austro-Hungarian Empire collapse, all those monarchies collapsed after World War I, and the communists took over, and actually money became public property through welfare societies, guaranteed income and all that, or unemployment insurance. So the traditional wealthy, ancient wealthy, were on the sidelines, but they had to stay in touch with what's going on. So I worked for them and would go around to labs and different things that were happening. It was not the military-industrial complex. We were involved with them. We knew what they were doing. They knew about us. They respected my employers and their wealth and all that. And then we got retrieved in the 80s with the front man, Prince Charles. Our money was the only money viable in the digital 80s. And so we got back into more influence than we'd been for 50 years, from 30 to 80. So I'm just clarifying that we were not really a military-industrial operation. We were obsolesced by that, but we still had our networks and our knowingness. When you see British movies, they show maybe the Lord Cecil family dealing with somebody, some radicals in the 80s in London or something. Those people, it'd always be these aristocrat guys lurking in the background in British movies, British TV shows. That's who I work with, and they show that because it's more public there in Britain.
Up in the canyon, wasn't there some kind of military complex that
basically
did movies and those kind of things?
Okay, so that was at the top of the hill, top of the canyon. You go up Laurel Canyon Boulevard and you get to Mulholland Drive. When you get to the top and meet Mulholland Drive, driving up Laurel Canyon Boulevard, on the right, you turn a sharp right down Woodrow Wilson Drive. That's where Mama Cass had a house. That's where Zappa's house was. And then you would drive. On the way up to Mulholland Drive, you could go halfway up Laurel Canyon Boulevard and go off on the side to these other side streets before you get to the Mulholland Drive. That in-between point from Sunset Strip up to Mulholland Drive is what the area we're talking about. And a lot of the hippie musicians, you know, the what's the folk singer? Joni Mitchell. Joni Mitchell was involved with these guys. So, because I was involved with Zappa from 64 on, I would go and see where Frank was. Well, he moved into the log cabin after Vito and the Dancers moved out, and the freak scene was started by Vito and the Dancers. So he moved into the log cabin after playing in New York, and now David, the author of this Laurel Canyon book, comes along, and because Frank's father was in the military, he says Frank ran the network out of log cabin. And Frank's daughters and wives are pissed off at this. Frank was the one putting out albums in 1967, the album We're Only for the Money, saying on the album, meanwhile the CIA is creeping around Laurel Canyon, Frank's exposing these people that David's saying that Frank is running. And this is the big, big flaw in his book, in his thesis, is that he gets the role of Frank all wrong. Now, the guy that's skulking around the canyon is me and my buddies. But we're not CIA, we're not FBI, we're not trying to arrest people. We just want to see who's doing what to whom. So I wasn't bureaucratic. You know, I wasn't someone going to arrest somebody. But the Gordon Liddy's and that were around trying to arrest people. So you have to make that distinction. I got a message from Michael Brown, you may not know him, from South Africa. He said I should interview this guy, David, because he thinks it's pretty good. But it wouldn't be a good interview because I would refute everything he says and wouldn't help him. He also is not a very good interviewer anyways. Okay, that's the background.
I didn't read his book. I just listened to his interviews. But I found fascinating, like, Jim Morrison's father was in the military.
Listen to this, Renee. It gets even better. Jim Morrison's father is very important in the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964.
And that's what he said.
And I've commented on this through the years. You have the father of Jim Morrison maybe causing the funding of the Vietnam War once LBJ moves in after JFK is assassinated. So you have the father being part of the key thing that justifies the increased troops going in. And his son is a major figure in the counterculture, which shows you on the chemical body content level that the opposing forces are actually working together, consciously or unconsciously. That's what should be emphasized. And this is really shown well in Apocalypse Now. That movie, you have the establishment trying to save their stuff. They're trying to save visual space, and the young kids are trying to retrieve acoustic space. Both of them are subject to the immutability of tactile space, which is the electronic global theater. And so neither Jim Morrison nor his father understood the larger effects of tactility becoming an environment. When you understand that, then you have a whole different view of this history.
Were you under a department, or were you a free agent?
I worked for a small team in Europe, basically the richest people in the world in terms of Europe. We were butlers for 300 years. Dickens writes about our family, my great-great-great-great-grandfather, in one of his journalistic stories. The thing is that we're pretty free because we don't need money. We're not salary people. We just need to keep seeing what new technology is going on so that we can figure out a way to get back into power. Or to get back into some authoritative level, which if you read my diaries in the late 50s, early 60s, my father starts telling me, this is not going to work. Nobody's going to have power is the way things are unfolding, which is what happened.
I found it very curious that there were several high-profile band members that actually had military connections.
They all did. The ones he mentions a lot of them, they all did, which is pretty interesting. I mean, even Gail Zappa, as a kid in Florida, she bumped Jim Morrison over the head like they're in the playground. They're like 6 or 7 years old. Her father, she told me, died in 67. And once Frank Zappa had met Mae Brussels and started listening to that, the first thought Gail got is, oh, my father got murdered because he got caught in the wrong faction or something. Even the weirdness of Neil Young, you know, hitchhiking down there, shows up and he's got a contract the next day. You know, comes to L.A. and
went too smoothly.
Right. But that's in retrospect. Zappa would say that the managers of the record industries, the mafia and the level of control been around for a long time, since the 50s, did not understand the effects of satellites and television, nobody did, on the kids. So the kids were different by the mid-60s. They were taking drugs and all this stuff. And the elite monitoring of the industry to see who the next big band would be did not understand why these kids were creating their own scenes. And then that created Sunset Strip in 65-66, which led to the riots in Sunset Strip, which led to all kinds of new issues. Zappa says if there wasn't that chaos, he would never have gotten a record contract. It was only because the managers, the record company executives, did not understand that they threw up their hands and said, well, whatever the kids are doing, we'll sign them. And they were signing everybody. So there was that environmental effect that allowed things to happen smoothly for kids who had bands who couldn't even play, but they had some good image and they were in a couple of clubs.
Yeah.
They got signed
immediately. Like all of them were like the Monkees.
Well, the Monkees was, that's 68. That's 67, that's the programming of it.
I'm jesting because, you know, they didn't play any instruments until they were thrown into it. But is it correct that, like, Charles Manson obviously was in one of the Beach Boys' houses, but across the road and down one was Abigail Folger?
Yes, yeah. Charlie Manson was very much part of the scene. He approached Frank Zappa. Frank tells the story and asked Frank to record him for Frank's new label called Bizarre Straight. That was in 67, 68. So Manson was floating around and had some kind of musical ability. Now, when you talk to Dave Worster, I got involved with Dave Worster in 69, and we were talking about Manson because we showed up a month after Manson happened in September 69. We spent many months with Dave in Seattle. Dave couldn't get over the fact that the record label that Manson put his music out on was called the Awareness Label. And Dave channeling cosmic awareness, or even just awareness, this awareness indicates. And so Dave was the the first person to do what I call xenocrony, to notice his life being in the media, in major events. He was the first to see that. And that was an example, is that this maniac, you know, has this record album, he calls it Awareness.
Do you think that Manson was pushed by the military complex in order to get, like, Folger and Tate and everybody?
Yeah, sir. Everybody's manipulating everybody because nobody understands who's running what. See, you want to get Mae Brussels' recordings on Manson. He was in the cell. His cellmate was one of the old mafia guys, and he learned a lot from that guy. Then he gets out. You can't tell if it's chicken egg who was doing what. There are factions in the LAPD that want to really ruin the image of the hippies. And so maybe a few of those guys saw this Manson thing and encouraged it to go this way or that way. But it's pretty impossible to find out, just like a good TV show, who's doing what to who. But definitely there's people attempting to conspire, attempting to ruin the media images. And there are others that are totally naive and don't know it and getting sucked into Manson. And then there's people like Zappa who knew to stay away from it. There's a novel about this, Thomas Pynchon's, called Inherent Vice. That is about the period right after August 69 when the paranoia goes through Hollywood, goes through Laurel Canyon. Everybody changed. It was no longer that environment of Jack Nicholson, Dennis Hopper, a couple other guys.
Yeah, they were up there taking care of business, too.
Well, they were having a good time. They were making Easy Rider, but Easy Rider is about after Manson. You know, because Nicholson and Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda are having a good time, taking acid and having fun, say, in 65 to 68. That's a great period, and I got to experience some of it there. A lot of fun's happening, and Joni Mitchell is there, and she's hanging out with everybody. She even played a little bit with Zappa. But the thing is, when the Manson thing happened in August 69, it actually happened, I think, on J.W.'s birthday. J.W.'s birthday is August 8th, and I think that's the day it happened, which is interesting. J.W. would have been 4 years old. And Woodstock's going to happen a week later, in the middle of August, 69. But nobody knows that Woodstock's going to be what it turns out to be. So you have the people on the bottom-up level making new imagery that's just shocking the establishment. Then you have the bureaucracies running around trying to figure out how to interpret it, how to say what it means.
So the establishment was very scared of this league that was going on. So that's why.
Well, that's a major factor. The major factor in the murder of Kennedy. Ion says Kennedy killed himself, but then there was people facilitating that. The reason Kennedy became a threat, he was so charismatic on black and white TV, maybe even color was starting to come in 61 to 63, that the establishment didn't understand how that was a virtual power, a virtual charisma. They were just like anybody else, loving TV, watching TV, and they said, holy shit, this guy's getting way more attention than us, and we are secret big brother guys, the Rockefellers and that, and we're not able to control the emotion that Kennedy's putting out on TV, and that made them scared, so they misinterpreted the TV effect and shot him because they thought he was becoming powerful.
It was a huge love fest.
Yeah, the effect of his image. That was a new kind of charisma and power that shocked the establishment. So there's always the media level of causation that people were not aware of. And, of course, Hoover took advantage of this. Hoover took advantage of the fear among Rockefeller and everybody. I really recommend a very good book, American Tabloid, by James Ellroy. That is the perfect description, as much as a human could describe, the events from 58 to the Kennedy assassination, is showing J. Edgar and everybody else's role in there, J. Edgar Hoover and that. But anyways, back to this book. You're surprised, it's interesting information, that these kids come out of the military families, and go in there, and maybe they had some influence on management so that Neil Young's band got...
It just seemed, you know, as I listened to him talk, and, you know, some things he say may be flawed, it was just a huge setup.
But it isn't. You have to look. There's these huge environments, huge bureaucracies. You got the FBI, you got the Department of Education, you got the Department of Welfare, whoever gave out the food stamps. Anybody could have food stamps back then. There was an incredible abundance in the late 60s of hardware and software, software being TV and music and movies. So all this abundance is happening, and Hoover's going nuts trying to figure out what's white, what's black. Are we going to, you know, do we allow Martin Luther King to continue?
Sure,
civil rights
should we start me? Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, it's confusing. I mean, you got the elites. Their kids are taking acid and drugs. There's no class distinction or protection of the upper kids. They're actually doing more of it. They're more down in the slums than the middle class kids. So in that confusion, the CIA, the FBI, everybody has to come up with agendas to keep getting funding, and they don't know what to look for anymore. America is more communistic in terms of the wealth that's happening than any Russian thing, so it's all mixed up. And, of course, people start getting pissed off. You know, you have the right wing, the neo-Nazi party starts coming up. So you have all these factors, and there are in the police forces and in the KKK groups and different groups and in the left conspiring to kill people, to set up people. Everybody thinks that if they use the media and they get the story out, it's going to be a big deal. What they don't understand is there's going to be another story 48 hours later that's going to obsolesce your story. So, yeah, you get 30 seconds of your story out, and then you think you've made global recognition, but you don't notice that, yeah, your story is one of a thousand that's going to happen this week. And that was where the naivety was. People thought, even the hippies thought, get on the media and make a message, that your message would change the world. That was the naivety on all levels of class and institution. They still thought it was an information environment. It was becoming a post-information environment, a static environment.
I knew you had your hands there.
I fortunately didn't have to take responsibility for what I learned or knew because I wasn't an American citizen and I wasn't responsible for quotas. A cop has to bust a certain number of people each week and ticket cars and all that stuff. So it was a very slackful position I was in. I just had access to everything. Here's a story that surprises the hippies, is that the week that Hoffman took acid in 1943 was the week that my father and I visited his lab. And we didn't know that was the week he was going to do it, but we wanted to find out what was happening in 43 with the new psychedelic stuff that was being made in Switzerland. And we were there at that lab. And years later, when Hoffman wrote his diaries or wrote a story, there was the week we were there. So I happened to be in the middle of a lot of stuff, but didn't fully know the full implications of it all, but we were there.
Yeah.
In other words, we were like, what do you call someone, a gossip hound? Who's someone who has to be wherever the latest thing is? Anyway, a trendmonger. We were actual, very well-supported and intelligent trend groupies. Whatever was happening, you know, you take the James Bond movies. They always found out, oh, there's some guy, he's got a lot of money, he's got an island, he's going to make a satellite and blow up London or something. So James Bond had to go in there and stop it. It was those kind of phenomena that we were always monitoring. It was slightly like James Bond, but James Bond had to do something about it. We didn't.
You were just a monitor. You didn't implement anything.
No, because we did not have the bureaucracy. We were obsolesced on the sidelines, and we weren't allowed back in until the 80s, when we were the only ones that had any functioning money and credit, whereas Rockefellers had bankrupted themselves with their foreign aid and loan policies of the 60s and 70s.
Uh-huh.
So we were sitting pretty, and so everybody needed our money, and that's why Prince Charles, I introduced Lady Di to Prince Charles. He marries her to have a trophy wife that goes around and entertains the mayors and governors while he does the talking to the bankers around the world that needed his money.
One talk show host does say, look at a picture of General George Washington and look at a picture of Prince William. Are they
right.
not related?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Ask Ion.
Because he had said that they had to bring the correct lineage back in because the Windsors were German.
Yeah, they're German. Who said this?
Sean David Morton.
A friend of mine on the East Coast went to an expo in New York a couple of weeks ago and went to Sean Morton's lecture and was shocked at how fat and out of shape the guy is. He hasn't got a very good chemical body image.
He always complains that he's broke and this and that, and he's psychic. It's like, if you're that psychic, get some billions of dollars in your pocket. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, right.
He does have a lot of interesting information, and, you know, you have to go and research it.
Well,
yourself.
That titillates you. If you're an information, a pattern recognizer, which is what everybody's addicted to today, is getting patterns, and that's what you listen to these guys for. They give you instant patterns about this and that. Usually it's all limited to top-down paranoia, though, with a little bit of technology thrown in. They don't have the broader bottom-up effects that I'm good at explaining. So it's not as comprehensive, their pattern recognition. But they're just feeding your addiction to new patterns, because every day you wake up, you got your chemical body, but you got your mind body, which is your TV and chip body, looking for patterns of all this information swirling around you. So you're an Android processor is what we call you. And when you're listening
I understand that, but it's still intriguing. It's kind of like reading a book and you're doing the James Bond thing, and you're not an insider, you're an outsider, so you got to figure out what's going on.
Well, that's the involving nature of electric information. It's a drama of constant trying to figure out what the pattern is, and that's why detective shows are so important and cop shows are so popular. They mime the detective archetype, which began with Edgar Allan Poe. He was the first guy to sort of create the detective story in response to the evolving nature of the electric telegraph.
Is today the day after X Day, or is it still X Day?
Yes, this is the big day, July 5th. This is the day when the X's were supposed to land 22 years after my father died, July 5th, 1976. They were supposed to come July 5th, 1998. And you can buy a tape of the big waiting for it that they did in upstate New York. And in the end, because the X's never showed up, all the subgeniuses tarred and feathered Stang and threw him into a pond, okay? I claim the X's came in 1988 via the Evergreens, 10 years before. And then, of course, 11 years later, the real X's show up, Ion, and they're still reeling from that.
So the Evergreens told you that the X's had landed in Russia?
Not landed. They made a major contact in the summer of 1989. To the point the NATO started organizing UFO departments. Six countries did that, and so did Russia, and then that's when Bill O'Reilly started sightings and all that UFO stuff started happening in 1990, 1991, and 92, and then X-Files happened, and the whole opening of the meme after that.
That was all based on what the Evergreens told you?
No, it was based on the contact that the Russians got in Moscow that was reported to Gorbachev. The Evergreens told me what Gorbachev said when he heard about it. It was like, you know, undeniable proof that there, something had landed there outside Moscow, and the Evergreens said, Gorbachev said, well, then what we're doing looks pretty stupid, if that's the case. I think he meant, you know, humanity in general looked pretty stupid compared to these advanced beings.
And you played off that for a good decade, if you listen to your archives from the 80s.
Yeah, the Evergreens never revealed anything about the UFOs. Basically, they kept a closed mouth because it was such an important human event. They didn't want anybody to know anything because it would alter humanity's response to it. But they did give in and tell me about it.
You go back in the 80s. I've been listening to your archives, the Bob and Mike show.
Yeah.
And you bring up, well, now that the X's have arrived, I mean, you played off the X's arrival that whole
thing. Yes, the X's arrived on, I said, in February 88. And that's basically going to three Zappa concerts. And then I, on February 24th, announced the election. Then I won the election on March 3rd, 88. That whole sequence,
yeah.
I'm saying the X's have landed and therefore we can have the vote and they helped me win and all that. So what the Evergreens told me in 1989, they go, I'm asking about this rumored thing, this contact. And they start to answer and then they go, now this is the first time we've ever said this. And then they said it and they confirmed it. And then I would pursue it a little bit, and they told me a little bit over the next couple of years, but eventually they shut up and wouldn't say anything. And George Renault, he tried to get stuff on the UFOs. That's Greg's friend and the guy who had the most sessions because he had a lot of money and paid for a lot. He eventually and I met in 2003, and we swapped our sessions, so he got to hear all the UFO stuff that he couldn't get that I got. You know, I got to hear all his different sessions that he did about the future. And Greg was on one of them.
You haven't shared.
Yeah, I have not played those. Yeah, they're his. I can't play them.
No, what the Evergreens told you about the X's.
They predicted the contact, and we found out from Ian a couple years ago that it did happen in China in 95 when the Evergreens predicted it. The contact on the that Soyuz joint spaceship up there, the Soviets and the Americans.
What's fascinating just about that whole thing is comments you make in, I guess I'm going through 89 at the moment, they're very similar to comments you make about Ion now.
And I'm talking about the Evergreens?
25 years ago. Or the X's.
The X's are the Evergreens. and Michael didn't want to get that much publicity, so I would talk about the Evergreens and call them the X's. So I was saying that I had contact with the aliens,
okay.
And I was meeting the Evergreens. I didn't think the Evergreens were aliens, but I would play, and so you would hear me talking this weird, strange English accent, and I would claim that's me talking to the X's. But it was just the Evergreens. But the Evergreens were so good and the sound was so weird, it sounded like I was talking something strange. Then it became a fact with Ion.
That's what amazes me.
Yeah, it anticipates what I'm...
So similar, yeah. It's
in other words, I'm acting out talking to Ion back in the 80s.
Yes.
Talking to the Axis, which I would say Ion is, which the Church Subgenius predicted, because Bob's the liaison between Earthlings and the X's. And
yeah.
So I claim the Evergreens were that. They weren't, but the concept of me talking to the X's, that we anticipated what actually happened. Yeah.
If Ion picked you, Ion was listening
to
those statements you were making, and that's all through your history of archetypes.
And that you should be impressed with. You should be feel very less
so.
Than.
That's where it hits me and goes. It doesn't make me less than.
Well, we hope not, but it always does in the long run. But if I keep being an idiot, then it'll help you retrieve your greater than state.
Yes, see, you're all things to us, Bob.
That's right. But it is incredible what was happening there. In other words, it was proving there's no time. I knew. Some part of me knew what was coming, and I was acting it out.
And that's what validates and confirms for me, or for all of us little men, because you come across that in a recording from 25, 27 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait, didn't he just say that last Saturday night?
Right.
You know, it's surreal.
It's the greatest theater, the greatest art form. It's the only way you could be a great artist today, a great playwright, in an information environment that obsolesces all theatrical events. How could you do it? What I did is the way to do modern playwriting. It's Shakespearean. And actually produces something. It's not an abstraction like Gutenberg culture. That just leads to abstraction. We're actually producing a food and a new civilization and breakthrough energy. I mean, nobody's going to top that.
And it's done... under, would you say, Manipian satire?
Yeah, like, under ridiculous conditions.
Manipian satire.
can you imagine if Edison had a medium and Tesla had a medium and they would feature the medium, but their medium would never be acting up like a fucking numbskull raucous asshole that Ion does. He comes out with a fake black accent and he does this and shit. Yeah. You motherfucker. Yeah, no, nobody would imagine the second coming would be like this.
They wouldn't listen to him.
Yeah, they wouldn't listen to it. And Ion does say, if we did this 40 years ago, Bob, we would have been fucking murdered. We would have been arrested and hung. Which shows you how much it's changed the last 40 years.
Yeah.
But just look at Ion. I mean, he's like a little kid. He won't answer sometimes. He tells people to go fuck themselves. The next time he's loving them up. And then he's saying this and that, and then he's dumping the formulas on us, and then he's acting ridiculous, and he's demanding us to pay attention to yoga.
Well,
he's the guy who swears into the microphone.
Nobody would have listened 30 years ago.
That's
now,
right.
Now we can't stop listening. That's bizarre, too.
Yeah, it has perfect pitch. Well, the more you understand it, it's so resonantly deep and perfect. It's the perfect communication, the perfect public performance. It's the Oracle of Delphi, you know, more real than Delphi.